Hey gang, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Berlindi, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Thanks again, John, for letting us use your music. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to a dear friend of mine, David Eichelbaum. David is based down in Ojai, California. I have known him now for, 10 or 15 years. He is one of the great repair people when it comes to vintage acoustics. Every time I go to his workshop, I see some priceless Martin or Gibson getting worked on. David also, though, is a maker in his own right and has built some pretty exceptional acoustics and electrics over the years. He did help me out, way below his pay grade, I might add, with my parts caster that I finished earlier this year. And he is just an invaluable resource. I know he is often on the Martin Guitar Forum, as well as I believe there is a Vintage Martin Facebook group, sharing all sorts of insights and knowledge and photographs. So glad to be able to talk to him. He is truly one of the great repair people of our time. In Fretboard Journal news, before we get to that interview, doing a little spring cleaning here, preparing for our 44th issue, which has just been printed and bound and is going to be mailing to subscribers all around the world later this week. I hope you guys enjoy it. This was a very cool issue for us. Sometimes you put out a magazine and the cover story is like the big story. With this issue, it was kind of a mind meld thing. It felt like there were about 10 stories that were the length of a typical cover story, and they were all equally cool. So everything from the restoration of Speedy West Bigsby guitar to features on Mandolin Orange and the guitars of Johnny Winter, like there's so much crammed into this issue. It's the Fretboard Journal 44. If you are a subscriber, you're going to be getting it in the next couple of weeks. And if you're not a subscriber, you can join us now by going to fretboardjournal.com and clicking on the subscribe tab. I also am happy to announce that I have been listening to all of you people who want to subscribe this, want to support this podcast, want to help us out, understand that we're reader supported and listener supported, but have told us time and time again, I have no interest in a paper based magazine anymore. And so as of last week, we are offering digital subscriptions to the Fretboard Journal. It's a PDF format available on pretty much any device, whether you want to look at it on your giant computer screen or your tablet or your phone even. It's a PDF. It's yours to keep, and you get four issues of the Fretboard Journal, all the content found in our paper edition as a PDF. So you can download that. You can order that by going to fretboardjournal.com and clicking on the shop tab. And then I think there is a digital download or download link. You'll find it there. It's $29.95 for four issues. And we are actually throwing in two bonus issues right now, including the electric guitar annual that we put out last year. So for all of you folks who want to help us out in a big way and help the Fretboard Journal empire grow, that is a very cool way to do it without having to worry about what your mailman is up to or what your wife's going to do if you start subscribing to print magazines again. On the podcast front, we have a ton of great interviews lined up over the next couple of weeks. I've interviewed Steve Earle. I've interviewed Tal Wilkenfeld. I've interviewed a bunch of great artists and luthiers. So if you haven't subscribed to this podcast yet, I hope you will do so however you subscribe to podcasts. And if you have a long commute like I do and need another podcast in your life, I encourage you to check out our latest edition of The Truth About Vintage Amps. It's where I co-host a podcast with amp guru Skip Simmons. I would say about half of our listeners are rabid amp fiends. And the other half probably don't even have an amp or an electric guitar. They just like hearing Skip explain how amplification works. And Skip does an exceptional job with that. It's kind of like car talk, but for electric guitarists. It's hilarious and informative. So check out that podcast if you haven't yet. We are having a blast doing it. That is all of our announcements for this week's podcast. I'm going to get right into it with David Eichelbaum. Check out his work. He's not on Instagram yet. David, you need to join Instagram, but he is around and you can check out his website and his Facebook page. And I can say without a shadow of a doubt, if you have any Martins or Gibsons or anything in your life that needs a repair, he will do exceptional work. So that's my plug for David Eichelbaum. And here is our talk. David Eichelbaum, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Hey, Jason. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
I consider you a good friend. We've talked a lot about guitars. You've helped me out with guitars over the years. but you're kind of an interesting guy, and I'm not even talking about your car hobby, because you're always busy, but your website, I got to be honest with you, is like ancient. And so how is it that every time I come to your shop, I see priceless Martins, rare Gibsons, a 59 Burst, maybe a Black Gartelli? You're getting all this work, but is it all word of mouth?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the website is really, you know, representative only of, you know, building, you know, my own guitars. And honestly, that's the side of things I haven't really promoted for quite a long time. And so I don't bother to update it.
Perfect.
But you know, my career, I guess, if you want to call it that. And I was doing some math the other night when we talked about doing this podcast, and was shocked to sort of come up with a number of 30 years that I've been playing around with guitars. And, you know, it's taken different forms. You know, I focused on different things at different times over the years. So that was a, you know, definite period of time that for 15 years, all I did was build guitars. But I started doing repair work initially, and that morphed into building. And as you know, I think mostly what I do now is what I would refer to more as restorative work rather than repair work. And so the website, I should probably have a better website and a better online presence. But as you know, I'm just not that interested in technology. So I plug away. I'll say this and then probably have to expand on it. But I have this theory and idea that has sort of played out that I think the people that need to find me, or we find each other, and that's kept me busy. So I'm always surprised a little bit when people that I, you know, have never met do find their way here and end up having long relationships with them. I'm not surprised, but I'm surprised that they just continue to come out of the woodwork in a way. Yeah. But I'm not that far from L.A., so that's where a lot of it really comes from.
I
don't know if it answered your question.
We've talked on this podcast before with Mark Stepman and T.J. Thompson and those guys. You know, people send them guitars from around the world, but they're both on the East Coast. You're sort of the West Coast version of what they're doing, very high level. I know you also do, not, you know, less, they're not all just priceless guitars, but you're doing very high level restoration work with some pretty big ticket guitars, and you're based, for folks who don't know, in Ojai, California, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world. But you didn't grow up there, did you?
Oh no, I grew up actually on the East Coast, so good thing I didn't stay, right? But I've been in California for, I think, since 1991. So, you know, a good portion of time, and in this area for most of that time. I was in Santa Barbara for about 12 years and now Ojai for, I don't know how long, 17, 18, 19 years, something like that.
And when did the world of luthery, for lack of a better word, enter your life?
Yeah, good question. It was really, you know, in college, I guess, that I became sort of, music was always, you know, an interest of mine. And I knew some guys, in school that played guitars, and I will never really forget seeing one of them bring this newish Martin. I guess it was a D28 or something. And I guess the guitar, you know, was fairly new, so it would have been, I don't know, mid-80s or something like that. And I just, you know, was pretty blown away by this incredibly expensive, fancy-looking guitar. And that sort of is what started it. You know, I could play a little bit at that time, and the more people that I met that, you know, were in music groups, bands, so on and so forth. I somehow just sort of became the guy that could tinker on their guitar. And, but it was always a hobby. It was always, you know, sort of a background thing. I was, you know, trying to do other things, in my life at the time. And, it just stayed there for probably a good 10 years. But, I guess that's how it entered my life.
Did you ever go formal education with it, or was it all pretty much self-taught?
No, I'm completely self-taught. You know, of course, back then there was really no other option. There weren't many people to go talk to, you know, that were even attempting to make a living at repairing anything guitar-oriented. I had an interesting, you know, I was into cars. That was sort of my main thing. And I was always also interested in just about anything that was a craft. And I knew some people who did various things like furniture restoration and things like that. And they would help me, you know, when I would run up against issues like, you know, what to do with finishes and things like that. I went running to the furniture repair guy. You know, what does this look like to you? So this is all very, you know, pre-internet and whatnot. So I had to dig the information up, you know, wherever I could get it. And even building, you know, I kind of didn't really. The only thing I did to learn how to build a guitar was I read William Campiano's book. And use that as sort of a launching pad. But no, I figured all that out the hard way too. So it's different now, I suppose. You know, even I can use the internet to look up how to do stuff. But I don't know. There's something to me that even though the learning curve was probably a little less steep, I don't know. It sticks with you a little more when you struggle, I think, to figure things out.
Sure. What brought you to Santa Barbara?
Well, cars. Okay. I got a job in Santa Barbara from Virginia, which is where I grew up, working for an automotive company that did aftermarket and reproduction parts for the British car industry. And that's what I was interested in all through high school and college was British cars. My very first car was a very, very, very worn out Triumph TR4. So I moved out here to work for them and worked in kind of an R&D position. I worked with manufacturers, you know, not designing parts, but reproducing parts from original blueprints and doing quality control type work and it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that work. I was a business major, so I was wholly unqualified for it, but I managed to talk my way into it, and I enjoyed it. But I did that for about 5 years before I basically took a leap of faith and turned the guitar repair business into a full-time thing. And it happened, I think, right after the very, very first Healdsburg Guitar Show Festival. And I think that was in 1995. Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was 1995. And I had gone up there and, you know, I went there with the intention of sort of, you know, meeting some of these, there might have been 30 builders or something at it. And I had built a few guitars and I wanted to, you know, I had some questions. And I went up there and I was trying to ask these guys, you know, the builders questions and whatnot. And that's where I first ran into Kevin Ryan. And he and I sort of became fast friends. And I made a few trips down to his shop when he was still in his parents' garage down in Westminster. And that's the closest I ever got to any sort of help. And Kevin was very helpful, but you know, he was and is a very smart guy, and he was always happy to share things. But you know, I think he gave me a piece of advice, which was, you know, I'm happy to share what I do, but, you know, take it and do something with it that's your own, which was very useful. And of course, I wasn't really interested in copying what he was doing, but he was always very free with his information and help. And I know he has been with lots of guys, but that was the closest I ever got to any kind of formal, you know, education or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
The rest of it is just the school of hard knocks.
And how good were those early guitars?
Oh, they were all fantastic. No, I think we all have a few guitars out there that, you know, we'd like to have back or something. But it's interesting because they all find homes and they tend to find the right homes eventually, you know, as a builder, you know, of guitars for 15 years, you know, I began to realize that the person that orders the guitar or initially buys the guitar from me, you know, may or may not be the person that ends up with the guitar ultimately. And it just, they kind of have a way of finding where they're going to land. And it's kind of interesting to get emails from people who say, you know, hey, I bought this guitar, you know, 10 years ago and just wanted to let you know I have it and you know, how much I've enjoyed it and whatnot. And so they find their way around.
Yeah. So you, you mentioned Healdsburg. And your website obviously reflects this, like, you know, for a lot of people, you were known as sort of the new, I guess, fingerstyle guitar, acoustic guitar maker. And then were you doing repair work the whole time too?
Some, yeah. When I started building full time, I guess in about 96, you know, and the repair work tapered off, you know, but I actually never really stopped doing it. I mean, I sort of always specialized, fortunately, in kind of, you know, Martins and things, but as you know, I also kind of have a double life as a electric ditch fender kind of guy, and so I would get jobs still trickling in as I was building throughout the years, you know, would do things like neck resets and stuff like that, and I built a, you know, fair number of electric guitars. I built a Telecaster once for Peter Egan, who was a columnist for Road and Track for many, many years. And my phone rang one day and, hey, I'm Peter Egan. And I don't know if you know who I am. And I'm like, yeah, of course I know who you are. You know, he writes about cars and guitars, and he wanted me to build him a Tele. So, yeah, I kind of maintained a low flow of work, which, you know, was great because when I decided to kind of shift things, you know, it didn't take a lot to, I wasn't starting from scratch to say, hey, you know, I'm taking on more work now. So I had a lot of clients that were still there, I guess.
Yeah. You're a very modest guy, but I'm curious, you're dealing with, you know, original Blackguard Tellies, you're one of the experts on those. You're definitely one of the experts when it comes to vintage Martin and Gibson restoration, but you've never really worked directly inside of a store or anything. I'm curious about how you got your feet wet with these ultra historic, ultra rare guitars and sort of what the learning curve was like.
Yeah. Well, I guess just, you know, my, you know, introduction to the, you know, guitar was really sort of the electric guitar, that, you know, which led to acoustic guitars, I did that little article, you know, for the electric version, sort of telling that story in the Fretboard electric edition.
Thank you for that.
But yeah, my initial, you know, interest in guitars was the Telecaster, and specifically, I was obsessed with the Bruce Springsteen's Telecaster, and that's kind of the you know, the thing that that I pursued for many years was finding out about those guitars. And I befriended the fellow that, you know, sold him that guitar and worked on it, Phil Patillo, and he taught me a lot or helped me with a lot. And I spent, you know, a good number of years buying and selling a lot of vintage Telecasters before they were unobtainium, you know, and that's how I ended up meeting Nacho Baños, who I know, you know.
Yeah.
And he and I shared a lot of information, but a lot of it was just hands-on. A lot of it was, you know, buying a guitar, looking at it, taking it apart, you know, keeping it for a while, selling it. I probably owned 35 Blackguard Tellies, you know, not all at once, but of my own that I just sort of rotated through, well, I'd say, you know, 50 up to 56 or 57. So not all Blackguards, but
you know,
I was buying those guitars for, you know, $3,000 or something, you know, and made money on a lot of them.
Sure.
So that market just took off, you know, and then of course my buying was curtailed, but I that was also a sort of a very small little side business of buying and selling vintage guitars on my own, and I bought and sold some Martins and some Gibsons J45s and L00s and things like that. This was all in the period of time before I really, you know, made this into a full time occupation. I had a job to sort of fund that those things at the time, but it's hands-on, really. I mean, that to answer your question, I have not ever worked in a store or anything like that, but I've seen a lot of these guitars.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of what you have to do. You kind of have to have hands-on and you know, pictures on the internet just don't do it. You still, when you open the case and look at a guitar, it just, you know, right away, you know, it's legit or it's not, or, and that just takes having seen them, you know, over and over and over again.
Sure. I know if I were in your shoes, my instinct when I bought a Blackguard Tele or something like that would be to take it apart and see what's going on. Did you ever do that with the old Martins or Gibson acoustics that you'd get?
Yeah. Well, mostly, you know, as I was doing the work, you know, you have to dig in and take them apart. And one of my own tutelage, when I started doing this, you know, you can't experiment with other people's guitars. So I went down to this sort of funky, I guess it was a pawn shop kind of vintage pseudo guitar shop in Santa Barbara. Cowboy Star Guitars, that's the name of it. And they used to have these junkers, you know, just these $10 and $15 junker acoustic guitars. And I bought, you know, I would go down and buy three or four of them at a time and take them home and just, you know, figure out, say, okay, what's inside of here, you know, and I would just destroy it, getting it apart. And then the next one I would destroy a little less, you know, and until I, you know, stopped destroying them, getting them apart. But here's the great irony, very cheap guitars, you know, the, you know, import guitars are actually much more difficult to get apart.
Sure.
Than Martins and Gibsons. They use glue that is some kind of magical substance that will never, ever let go. So anyway, that's when I decided I would never, ever work on, you know, Takaminis and Yamahas and whatnot. You can't get them apart. But that's how I learned what's inside and how to get things apart. You just have to dig in. I mean, it's there's probably a guitar out there somewhere, you know, that I should get back and fix. But, you know, I didn't do too much damage.
I believe you. You seem like a meticulous guy. So what's on your workbench right now? I'm curious.
Well, lots of stuff, you know, I've got the usual assortment of Martins and Gibsons all needing neck resets, and I spent the morning rewinding a pickup for a 1954 Strat, and I think, you know, I am lucky to have 59 Les Paul Burst sitting here for some very minor work, and yeah, there's a Larson Brothers guitar sitting here. The usual kind of menagerie of different things, and I like that. I really do. I like that. I enjoy all types of, you know, work, all types of guitars, really. I mean, mostly I tend to work on the Martins, but, you know, there are periods where all kinds of other stuff floats in, and there's always something going on.
And at this point, I mean, is there anything where you're still biting your nails and wondering what the heck am I doing with this, or is it all pretty much under control all the time?
Well, how can I answer this question? I don't think it would be interesting, you know, for any of us, if you sort of felt like you had it all licked. You know, it's always a challenge. It doesn't matter, you know, what the job is, even if you've done it 100 times, there's always the challenge to do it better or find new ways to do it that, you know, end up with a better result. I mean, my goal is really, I mean, my mantra is sort of get in and get out, you know, without anybody knowing I was there. And it's one thing to do the job. To do that is a whole nother thing. And that's endless, you know, it's endless finding ways to sort of improve on that. And that makes me happy. You know, when I get a guitar back, you know, see it again 5 years later or something like that, and the guy says, oh, yeah, I'm bringing you this guitar back that, you know, you did such and such and so on, and I look at the guitar, or maybe he doesn't say that, and I look at the guitar, and I'm like, you know, this guitar has never been worked on. You know, why are you bringing it? What's wrong with it? Or whatever. He goes, oh, no, you reset the neck 5 years ago or something. And I go, oh, crap, that's cool. You know? You know, I can't tell. I mean, that's when I get happy. You know what I mean? So I don't think anybody ever really has it all licked. You know, I mean, you try to work to a very high standard, but even at that level, there's always stuff to be learned and new techniques and new jigs and fixtures and things to do to help improve the final product.
Do you?
So, no, I don't have it licked.
Do you tend to work in batches, like I'm just going to work on acoustics today, or is it actually helpful to kind of bounce between the acoustics and the electrics when it comes to repair work?
I mean, this will sound, you know, sort of exceedingly practical, but I mean, I have to sort of juggle the workflow because I'm not a shop, you know, because I don't have other sources of income flowing in. I have to juggle in my head the repairs, you know, sort of to keep things flowing. You know, I have to keep getting stuff out the door. So, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. I sort of juggle it according to how it fits into the schedule. You know, if I have a fret job, you know, or 3 fret jobs sitting there, and 6 neck resets or something, you know, I'll probably do the fret jobs as needed to sort of keep cash flow going, because that's really, you know, I mean, I have to.
Yeah.
So it isn't so much determined by what the guitar is as much as sort of my needs to get work out of the shop. And I don't, you know, I have projects, you know, some projects that, you know, take time and, you know, inevitably, I mean, they're just things that, you know, can be here for a year or something. But I don't keep stuff around that long. I think that's something people have come to appreciate, is that I tend to get stuff in and out of here. And it's not that I'm rushing it, but I don't keep stuff for 6 or 8 months at a time, unless it's a very big project, really.
Got it.
Because I'm not juggling other stuff. You know, it's all I do, so. I can get it out pretty quick. I mean, a neck reset, 6 to 8 weeks at the most, really. You know,
not too bad. I know, we talked a little bit about your own acoustic creations, but you've also done some pretty incredible Fender recreations, right?
Yeah. I mean, mostly, all Telecasters, really. I've built a bunch of, you know, replicas, if you will, of specific guitars. I built the guitar that it was in the magazine, the replica of Bruce's guitar, But I've done a bunch of stuff for people. There are people out there who will call and say, you know, I want a 1952 Telecaster, or I want a 1953 Telecaster. I have one, but I don't want to play it because it's too expensive. Can you build me one that looks exactly like a 1950, not a 53 and not a 54, but a 52? And I find those projects to be really fun. I don't think it would be much fun to just build lots of them. You know, I like recreating very specific things.
In those cases, are people sending you the original instrument and you're copying scratches and everything, or how far are you taking it?
Oh, no. I don't really do relic stuff. I'm just talking about building things that, you know, have all of the correct manufacturing flaws and fingerprints, you know, that Fenders did, because, you know, they were built on very specific equipment, you know, very specific machinery, and all equipment, all machinery leaves behind, you know, fingerprints, if you will. It's a product of the method upon which it was made. These days, it's a little different. You have, you know, CNC machinery and whatnot, and there's not a lot of imprint left by the CNC machine. You know, it's pretty invisible. But in the old days, they had fairly crude equipment, and I will recreate, you know, the marks left by the pin routers and the routing plates and things like that, and just headstock shapes and whatnot that were all very specific to specific years.
And I got to ask, when you do that, are you actually using the nail hole that Leo Fender's people put in, or are you just putting that touch in, fabricating that because it existed on the original thing? Are you building them the way they were built back then?
As much as practical, yeah. I mean, as much as is practical. And in some cases, I'm recreating a tooling mark left by a piece of machinery that it would be about the size of my shop. So I don't own that machinery, but I know how to recreate the tooling mark left by it. I mean, those guitars, some of the parts that Leo made and some of the equipment that they used were, you know, massive punch presses and stuff, war surplus, essentially, things that were, you know, punching out landing gear parts for, you know, bombers years before. But, I mean, he had some very large equipment. So I don't obviously have that, but I know how to recreate the fingerprints of it.
It's pretty fascinating. Have you done that on the acoustic side of things too, where you see a cool guitar come across your bench for restoration and you're like, I need to make one of these?
No, the closest I ever got, I'll back up for a second. As far as the acoustics go, they're completely different animals to me. And I never had an interest in building copies or recreations of, you know, even my favorite guitars, even my favorite Martin designs. I was fascinated with building my own guitar, you know, designing something, you know, and building it the way I wanted to build it. I never wanted to be subject to a conversation wherein somebody would ask me why I had done something incorrectly. Yeah. You know, why did you not do it the way that Martin did it? I never wanted to be a part of that conversation. I still really don't. It doesn't interest me. And there were things about Martin's and Gibson's that I just, you know, knew were limitations of production. And I wasn't interested in those kinds of limitations. I wanted to, you know, to push the designs to where I wanted them to be, but I also wanted my own, you know, I wanted my own thing out there in the world. You know, I think we all seek some kind of identity, and that was part of what I, you know, was looking for. Was I wanted to design something and put it out there for the world to accept or not. But I did not want to be a Xerox machine.
Yeah.
And like I said, I didn't want to have that conversation. Nobody has ever pointed at a detail of one of my guitars and asked me why I didn't do it a different way, or why I didn't do it the Martin way, I guess.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. What else are you working on? I know I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about, we talked about your car obsession before. You've ramped it up a little bit. Can you tell folks about this?
I guess. I'm fascinated why anybody finds it interesting besides myself. But I had owned a bunch of cars and also was, as a kid, very fascinated with big trucks, you know, 18-wheeler trucks. And so about 10 years ago, I bought a 1973 Kenworth cab over. And that has been the subject of most of my spare time for the last 10 years. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I spend my weeks, you know, with, you know, calipers in my hand, you know, working on very delicate, you know, things. And then on the weekends, I break out the half-inch impact wrench and go to town. And it's kind of therapeutic. It's a scale, it's a juxtaposition of scale that's sort of freeing, you know, when, like I said, I work on delicate stuff all week long, and then I'm trying to move around a tire that weighs 200 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different set of problems, you know, so I kind of like that.
And for folks who don't know this story, which I'm guessing is everybody, you're not just working on this truck. It's this like a frame off every bolt new restoration, right?
It is. Yeah, it is. I mean, these trucks were built to a purpose, you know, they were built to do a job and they were, you know, they did not, I mean, they weren't built to last forever. And so this truck was, like many, you know, sort of a poster child for deferred everything. And, I had no intention of this. I swore off car restoration years ago.
But it accidentally fell in your lap?
Well, yeah, but I did not intend to restore it. I thought it would be fun to fix up and drive around. But then the deeper you get into something, the more you find out, oh, my gosh, this is broken too, and, you know, so on and so forth. It's usually at that point more, you know, more sane people, you know, sell the thing or they move on. And I don't know why I feel like I have to fix everything that crosses my doorstep, but I felt like it was my job. So here I am.
And what's the end goal here?
The end goal is to get in it and drive around the country and go to some, you know, events and have some fun, you know, for absolutely no good reason whatsoever.
All right. And how far are you from reaching that goal?
I have to get some paint work done, but I would say we're looking at maybe a year, another year, year and a half, which isn't so bad. When you consider how long it's been.
I was going to say, you've had it for a decade now, right?
Yeah.
Does the truck have a name?
No, not really.
No. All right. So for folks who want to find you, what is the easiest way? Still through your website?
That, or you can find me on Facebook. I actually have a little Facebook page for Eichelbaum Guitars. And I'm, you know, I'm on the Martin forums, Facebook forums, and the Gibson one. But do you want me to give out my email address or something?
Sure, if you want.
Yeah, it's just deguitars@gmail. You can reach me there or shoot me a, or call me or whatever. Shoot me an email. Everybody can just contact you, and then you can forward things.
Well, we already have a whole podcast where that happens, and it's it's filling up my inbox, so I don't recommend that.
No, I'm just kidding.
You can keep the AMP questions coming to me, but yeah, I can't be right. I can't do this multiple times. But yeah, I mean, the work that you're doing is at such a high level. I'm fascinated. I wish we could just install like a webcam in the corner of your shop and stare at you all day long. Because it's incredible. I've seen so many cool guitars in your shop over the years, and you've helped me out, and so I'm glad we're talking.
Yeah. Me too. I really appreciate it, and wish you were still in this neck of the woods, but I know you're enjoying being up in Washington.
Yeah, sort of. What are you gonna do?
Well, what are you gonna do, right? But yeah, well, thanks so much. I appreciate you having me.
Of course, David. Thanks so much.